Growing up in 1960s Los Angeles, my childhood movie experiences weren't exactly typical. At 7 years old, my mother and stepfather took me to see decidedly adult fare at the Tiffany Theater on Sunset Strip. I vividly remember watching Where's Papa and howling with laughter as George Segal, dressed in a gorilla suit, got punched in the groin by Ruth Gordon. These weren't children's films, they were my education in adult life. The movie theater became my anthropological field study. Like a child version of Grizzly Man, I observed grown-ups in their natural habitat through the flickering light of the silver screen. I learned the unwritten rules of cinema. Don't ask questions during the movie, save them for the car ride home, laugh when everyone else laughs, and absorb everything. I witnessed both the joy of communal movie watching and its ugliness, like audiences mocking gay characters. These formative experiences weren't just entertainment. They were shaping my understanding of storytelling, human behavior, and the power of film to transport an audience. What began as childhood fascination evolved into lifelong passion. The movies weren't just showing me stories, they were teaching me how to tell them. Each frame, each cut, each performance was a lesson in what would eventually become my own cinematic language. Bullet transformed cop movies from formulaic affairs into something stylish and revolutionary. Steve McQueen's Frank Bullet was a new kind of detective, one who exuded style and designer clothes and dated Jacqueline Bisset. McQueen's career peak came with crucial help from his first wife, Neil, who read scripts and guided him toward ideal roles like Bullet when he wouldn't read them himself. Peter Yates' consonant direction weaves together action, atmosphere, and San Francisco locations with Lalo Schifrin's jazzy score. McQueen's minimalist performance commands scenes through presence alone, with understated yet powerful reactions, whether missing the killer or outmaneuvering an ambitious DA. McQueen's physical performance style perfectly suited this stripped-down character, creating pure cinema that became the template for screen cops for decades to come. Don Siegel's Dirty Harry revolutionized American cinema by transforming action movies from westerns to cop films and launching the serial killer subgenre. But its true innovation was merging brutality with politics. Siegel's background in montage and second unit direction influenced his distinctive approach to violence, focusing on brutality over gore. Even after Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, Siegel maintained his reputation through economic, visceral filmmaking. Dirty Harry, Siegel and Eastwood's fourth collaboration, defined both careers and established Eastwood as America's premier action star. In Harry Callahan, they created a cop who believes society favors criminals over law enforcement. By pitting him against a fictionalized Zodiac killer, they established a template that influenced countless films. The film resonated deeply with Nixon's silent majority, Americans alienated by the social changes of the early 1970s. Harry Callahan became their champion against hippies, militant groups, street crime, and cultural upheaval. While not the fascist piece critics claimed, Dirty Harry was undeniably reactionary, transforming a police thriller into a cultural battleground. Deliverance peaks with one of early 70s cinema's most disturbing sequences. When Ed and Bobby encounter two backwoods men by the river, the scene transforms into raw terror. These aren't typical villains, but convincing predators, with the male rape scene unfolding with documentary-like brutality. The sequence's power lies in its authenticity. Bill McKinney's performance as the hillbilly attacker feels unnervingly real. After Lewis, Burt Reynolds, kills McKinney with an arrow, the men face a moral crisis, whether to bury the body or report the killing, knowing the area will soon be flooded. Lewis stalks like a judge in a wilderness court, his arguments wearing down his friend's resistance. Reynolds delivers a breakthrough performance, his survivalist character proving himself when it matters most. Though the film's final act wavers, with Drew's unclear fate and an anticlimactic confrontation, the central wilderness sequence remains a haunting exploration of masculinity under pressure. Deliverance transcends mere survival to examine what emerges when civilization's rules dissolve. The 1970s saw two competing filmmaking approaches. The anti-establishment auteurs created cynical films that challenged genre conventions, often alienating mainstream audiences seeking entertainment. In response, a new wave of accessible films emerged: The Godfather, American Graffiti, Jaws, Star Wars, offering fresh takes on familiar genres while maintaining broad appeal. These came from the movie brats, the first film school graduates raised on television. This tight-knit group included Coppola, Bogdanovich, De Palma, Scorsese, Lucas, Spielberg, and Schrader, who actively collaborated and supported each other's work. The movie brats' success stemmed from their deep appreciation of cinema history and their unique perspective from watching films both in theaters and on TV. They bridged the gap between art films and popular entertainment, leading a revolution that honored cinema's full heritage. Los Angeles Times critic Kevin Thomas influenced my work, starting when his review led me to Malibu High. Despite its tawdry nature, the film delivered the power Thomas described, and his ability to find merit in disreputable cinema resonated with me. His 1980 review praising Robert Forster's easygoing naturalness in Alligator, comparing him to characters from Return of the Secaucus 7, stuck with me after three viewings that year. 15 years later, while casting the bail bondsman Max Cherry for Jackie Brown, I remembered Forster in Alligator. Rewatching confirmed my instinct. That character could be an older Max Cherry. I wrote the role specifically for him, including details about his thinning hair. Thomas stood apart for his genuine enthusiasm and open-mindedness, bringing authentic joy rather than cynicism to his work. When I won an award from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association for Pulp Fiction, I quipped, "Gee, thanks, now I finally know what Kevin Thomas looks like." Brian De Palma was the first to consider directing Taxi Driver, but passed, deeming it not commercial enough, a puzzling choice given Columbia Pictures' later interest. Instead, he made Obsession, with Schrader as writer, continuing his Hitchcockian style. Though featuring Genevieve Bujold's strong performance and Bernard Herrmann's score, the film never achieved Taxi Driver's impact. A De Palma Taxi Driver would have differed fundamentally in perspective. While Scorsese made viewers inhabit Travis Bickle's world, understanding his loneliness and humanity, De Palma likely would have observed him objectively, crafting a political thriller about a disturbed would-be assassin, complete with his signature slow-motion sequences. Such what-ifs reveal how directorial vision transforms material. Scorsese's immediate visceral connection to the script, "I was burning inside my fucking skin," helped elevate Taxi Driver from vigilante film to masterpiece. The greatest films invite deeper engagement, asking us to examine every technical choice and artistic decision. They're not just entertainment, but a complex language through which we understand ourselves and others.